The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. Now, we've got a surprise studio-based podcast for you this week as we're taking a break from our live event series to catch up on the latest technology news. It has been a very busy few weeks on the technology desk and our inbox overfloweth. So this week we'll be reflecting on the main stories of the recent past and looking forward to the main stories of the future. We'll pay our respects to one of the greatest, yet most unsung heroes of the digital age. We'll be predicting the demise of a certain mobile hardware manufacturer, and we'll find out how another is trying to rise from the dead. We've got Charles Arthur's hands-on analysis of the latest iPhone and the Wikipedia founder's take on the UK startup scene. Yes, there is a lot to cover this week. So joining me in the studio to pick everything apart like a flock of wild buzzards on a carcass, our Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur and Guardian software engineer, the Reverend Dan Catt. Welcome both.
Hello.
Hello.
You will both note that I've not mentioned the biggest tenuously technology pop story of the week, Lady Gaga's successful court case versus London-based game developer Mindcandy, the creators of the enormously successful kids game Moshi Monsters. I'm sure, Dan, you know Moshi Monsters because you've got children of the age at which they are targets.
I do indeed, although they prefer Club Penguin.
Oh, right. Mm. Well, perhaps it's best that we didn't have Michael Acton Smith, the CEO of Mindcandy, on this podcast. And Charles, do you know Moshi Monsters? Are your kids a little bit too young?
I think we've bypassed them in my house.
Oh. Well, Moshi Monsters are now going to have to kill off the sunglass-wearing, blonde-fringed virtual character Lady Goo Goo. Dan, why?
Because Lady Gaga brought a case against them, saying it was... I believe they are playing off her brand too much, which I happen to agree with in this case, because I'm all for reuse and parody, but this seemed to be, my personal opinion, just too close.
Well, we will have more on this subject at our live Tech Weekly recording on the UK's creative economy on the 31st of October. More on guardian.co.uk/techweekly for all that information. But in the meantime, do keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Last week, the world's largest enterprise mobile phone system, BlackBerry, experienced an epic service meltdown. That is, of course, a technical term, Charles. What happened?
Well, RIM hasn't been entirely clear about why this happened. There are suggestions that they were trying to do a software upgrade or a hardware upgrade or a firmware upgrade even to some of the systems that they have at their network operations center in Slough, which handles all of the traffic for Europe, the Middle East and Africa and India. All of it goes through there, and all the GPRS data for the world goes through the network operations center in Slough. Something went wrong with a big W. And what was meant to happen then was that it should all fall over to a backup center located down in Egham in Surrey. Didn't quite happen. And when the failover happened, they say that there was a core switch failure, which sounds like a router meltdown, though they've not been clear about that either. And then things just started going bad. And from Monday, 11 o'clock in the morning, it went wrong and it continued going wrong through the week.
Obviously, there has been an enormous public outcry because this is the world's largest enterprise mobile phone platform. And to compensate, aka to save face, they will be giving affected users a package of £60 worth of apps. Now, Charles, you spoke with Stephen Bates at RIM. What did he have to say in the matter?
Yeah, Stephen Bates is the managing director for the UK and Ireland, and he started off by telling me about the scale of the problem.
The past 18 months, we've managed to deliver service availability of around about 99.97%, which is very high. Notwithstanding that, this issue that we've experienced is possibly the worst service issue we've encountered in the 12 years of our operation.
It is the worst, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We understand the nature of the problem. We've resolved the problem. What we've done, or what we have been doing, since last Friday when we announced that service was back and up and running is we've been doing detailed root cause analysis through our own systems and all of our suppliers to understand really what went wrong. Plus, this morning, as part of the announcement on this free app offer, we've also instigated an activity that will be led by David Yah, our Chief Technical Officer, who will do a root and branch investigation into our total architecture. And he has got a remit to do whatever's necessary to ensure that we maintain and deliver the high levels of services that we expect and our customers expect.
I have to say, that sounds to me not like a pledge that the same will never happen again. It sounds like you're still working out quite where the problems are. But my understanding from people who I've spoken to is that a large cause is the fact that, in effect, RIM runs its own internet. You have your own private networks. And as the amount of data that's been going over it has ballooned with your success in the consumer side, that it's just put an intolerable load onto those networks.
Actually, that's incorrect. We absolutely run our own infrastructure. However, we plan many years in advance with respect to network capacity and network build. And, you know, we have anticipated the success that we've achieved. The key thing with this one was that, as we've already stated, the core issue was this core switch that did not back up as it would normally do and has been tested. That's what we're investigating to understand what the circumstances were around that issue that happened when it previously worked and has previously been part of our normal testing procedures to ensure that that does work through that scenario.
So then is the fault, do you think, with something to do with the router code? So it's actually something which lies outside your systems, or is it to do with the code that you've written?
At this stage, we're not going to speculate. We're continuing with the investigation. What we're going to do is we're going to take some time on this. The fundamental resiliency of our network is what our customers expect. This is a rather complex network, and we're handling typically around about 22 petabytes of data every month for our 70 million customers globally.
Indeed, but surely part of the reason why you're handling that amount is because of the success that you've been having in the consumer side. Whereas the business user will be sending texts, short text-based messages on the consumer side, you're starting to get more pictures, you're starting to get YouTube videos, things like that, which occupy far more bandwidth. And the fact that you're encrypting both ends is surely putting a much greater load onto your systems.
What we're seeing is increase in traffic use for both business and consumer users. And that's well within the expected performance that we were planning for our network. So the absolute amount of data is not the relevance here. It's well within what we were expecting. And you know we've been planning our business for continued success, quite frankly, through this year and also into next year. Fundamentally, this is about a resiliency challenge that we faced, whereby through the planning of our network, we have multiple points of resiliency and backup, which we constantly monitor and constantly test, and we ensure that they should operate properly. But in this instance, we've had a core element within our infrastructure, and it didn't operate in the way that we expected it to do. So that obviously has caused us great concern. And secondly, the other challenge we faced with this particular issue was that it did happen in an intermittent fashion, because we believed we'd got to the bottom of it by Monday evening, and we were trying to clear the backlog of messages through Monday and Tuesday morning, only for another incident to occur on the Tuesday. So as you're aware, with these types of intermittent issues are rather complex to troubleshoot.
You've said that you're making these apps available, and that's going to be to all your 70 million users. Is that that's right?
We are making that available to users who have got access to, all customers that have got access to AppWorld. There's a second element to our offer which is related, because that app offer really is more for the consumer user. The second element to the offer that went out in the announcement this morning was around our enterprise / business customers, whereby for those enterprise customers that have the BlackBerry technical support service, we're going to provide an additional month without any charge. And for those business or enterprise customers that don't have the BlackBerry technical service, we will make that available for them to have use of that for a month without any fee.
You've had this very bad outage, and now it seems like the way that you're trying to sort of assuage that is by basically tying them more closely to the BlackBerry 7 or BlackBerry 6 platform by offering them apps, which is an interesting tactic to sort of hold the customers closer. What about when it comes to next year and you start releasing QNX-based devices? Surely the problem will be that those apps won't run on those devices, so the upgrade path for these people who've taken advantage of this won't exist.
Well, actually, we haven't really revealed the upgrade path for that yet.
In the light of what's happened in the past week, and bearing in mind the announcement you've made about the free apps, do you think that people are more likely today to buy a BlackBerry phone than they were last week?
Where we stand today, you know, BlackBerry is, certainly the UK, is the number one smartphone of choice in the market. So we've proven already that the customers want that communication experience, and our focus moving forward is to enhance that, to build on that, and to rebuild the trust our customers have in the platform that's made it the number one choice for the UK market.
Stephen Bates of RIM speaking to Charles earlier. Charles, Malik Sadi, who's an analyst at Informa, told the BBC earlier this week the total amount RIM should pay to refund its customers would be about $12 million a day. This amount does not take into account liability fees for loss of data or any related legal issues. This could mean RIM paying over $100 million, and this amount could escalate for every subsequent day the service is out of action. That's a whole bunch of cash. Will they be able to survive this?
Well, looking at RIM's stock price, it's been surprisingly unaffected, and at some points it was even going up last week. The reason for this, though, is because there's an increased expectation among analysts and people who sort of move stocks around that it'll actually get bought or broken up. There are some some stockholders who are very annoyed with Michael Lazaridis and Jim Balsillie, who are the co-chairman and co-chief executives of the company. And if you actually look at it, if you go on the basis that a company's market cap is equal to the total profits that it's going to make over its life, at its current run rate, the expectation is that RIM's market cap equates to about 5 to 8 years more life. So the market isn't actually rating it very highly. They're thinking that it's going to be dead quite soon or purchased.
And of course, this is not good news. Well, this incident isn't particularly good news after the numbers came out with regards to the playbook and all of the other technologies.
All the other numbers that they've had have been bad as well. So one has to look quite hard to find shafts of light in what is going on with RIM. I mean, the only thing you could say might look good is that the new line of phones, the BlackBerry 7 phones, seem by people who've tried them to be okay.
The real key is maintaining enterprise. But I heard a rumor, this may have been reported in The Guardian, that BlackBerry is being jettisoned in favor of the iPhone for some large organizations.
Well, certainly Juliet Garside had a story saying that Royal Bank of Scotland is experimenting with the iPhone as a replacement for the BlackBerry system. And I was at the weekend speaking to the IT manager of a large multinational bank, which is not RBS, who was saying, yeah, we're not very pleased with RIM at the moment. And they're looking at iPhones and iPads, and they can remotely wipe them. They can get secure access to them. They can prevent people from copying, pasting stuff and sending it on personal email. So they're starting to look at those as being quite secure. If they start to look at those as being is equivalently secure to BlackBerry, but they know they don't have to rely on BlackBerry services, then they're going to wonder why they go one rather than the other.
Well, find out more on the fallout on guardian.co.uk/technology. More positive news in the mobile world, however, as Apple's latest update to the iPhone hit shops on Friday, already shifting 4 million units globally. All the talk has been, well, directed at the handset itself, as the 4S includes voice recognition software that allows you to search, text, and type without the need for your fingers. So, now it's in your hands, guys. What do you make of it? is it worth the money? Charles.
Siri, what do I think of it?
Really? Sorry, Charles. I can only look for businesses in the United States, and when you're using U.S. English.
Okay, well, that's what the technology thinks. But Dan, without the benefit of Siri, which is a voice recognition software that we'll talk about in a second, what do you think of the 4S?
I'm enjoying it so far. I upgraded to get the camera, so I'm loving the camera. I hardly use it as a phone. I don't even know what the telephone number is for it. The Siri stuff, I was really surprised by how much I like it. I've only had it at the weekend, and I started saying, remind me in 10 minutes to do this, remind me 15 minutes to do that, and it just does it.
It does it?
And
Oh, okay, wow.
The location stuff. As an experiment, I went to buy some bread and milk, and I said, remind me when I leave the house to buy bread and milk. And sure enough, when I was about 5 minutes from the house, it went, don't forget this. So I easily see myself putting my favorite shops that I go to regularly in my contacts list because it needs to know where they are. But you can say things like, when I get to IKEA, please kill me or something like that.
I can easily see putting my brain into that, which is a slightly disturbing option, isn't it?
One could almost see it for Alzheimer's sufferers. I mean, you know, quite seriously, that something more advanced, I'm not saying iPhones are Alzheimer's people, but I'm saying that if you think forward a few years to when this becomes much more pervasive, much more simple to do, then actually this would make a lot of sense.
But there will be a din as everybody's like asking it to, oh, it's everybody's.
Is that a reminder for you, Alex?
Apologies. Phones off in the studio, please. As everybody's asking it to, you know, remind you to go to a Tech Weekly meeting or something like that.
Well, sort of. But I mean, the thing that's interesting here, and you know, a lot of people have said, oh, Siri was an app. It was an app already, and Apple had it, and it was on the 3GS upwards, and now it's only on the 4S. That's absolutely true. But equally, how many people used it? Not that many. And the thing about the 4S is that immediately there's 4 million users for this. So that if they try to extend it across all of the 3GS and iPhone 4 users, I think it would have been just horrendous. There's a lot of voice recognition software on board. Equally, people are saying, yeah, but Google Voice Search, been there for ages. You know, Windows Phone, they've got that already on Mango. What is happening here is that this goes beyond just, send a text saying I'm going to be late. It goes beyond that. It goes to, tell me the stock price for this or go and look up such and such. There's much more going on here just than simple voice functionality. And I think that this is probably where the next leap is coming. You know, 5 years ago or so, it was touchscreens. Apple wasn't the first with the touchscreen, but it was the first to really make a touchscreen seem a sensible way of interacting. And I think that now it's going to be doing it again with voice recognition, that you're going to say, well, yeah, of course you control your phone through your voice. And, you know, I can see in the future you'd be turning functions on the phone on or off, you know, turn off the Wi-Fi, turn on the Wi-Fi, those sorts of things. Although that's not in it yet, I can see it happening.
Dan, how does voice recognition software work in something like Siri?
Well, there's been lots of research into the natural language parsing behind it, where it's recognizing keywords and key phrases. And obviously it does quite a lot with your calendar and with your contacts list. So it's already understanding the names of the people in your contacts. But then when it can't recognize those, it sends snippets of what you said off to the server, where they have huge big computers that crunch it all through there. And then again, they're looking for keywords and so on and so forth. So it is definitely sitting on the big machines where they can work it all out and then sending it back. So it's a bit of both. It's a bit of on the client for the stuff it knows, and then it goes off remotely for the stuff it doesn't know. It works really well. It's surprising.
I think the interesting thing, which actually no one has really picked up on, is the fact that it requires no training. You know, no, you don't have to spend any time teaching it to recognize your voice. You can give your phone to anyone and they can use it straight away.
That is a classic Apple device sort of technique as well. And that truly, I think, is one of Steve Jobs' greatest legacies. But given that I've never touched one of these devices before, let's give it a whirl, shall we? I was wondering if we could test it in the studio just to see how it responds. So now I'm pushing the button. Oh, and it says, what can I help you with? And I'm going to tell it, what will the weather be like tomorrow, please, Mr. iPhone? It's thinking.
To whom shall I send this message?
Well, it seems to have thought that I said, whoa, okay, wow, it's shouting at me.
You could just ask it what the weather's going to be like tomorrow.
What's the weather going to be like tomorrow?
To whom shall I send this message?
Yeah, it's really confused. So,
I need a contact name.
No, I won't give you a contact name. Oh, absolutely not. I don't like you anymore. Set me a reminder for 8 o'clock tonight, please.
Okay, your message is addressed to Scott Cawley. Ready to send it?
I totally... Oh, send it now, for God's sake. Just put it out there, man.
Would you like to send, cancel, review, or change it?
Send.
Okay, I'll send it.
Yeah, I think that'll do. Apparently there are some good questions, though, you can ask it. If you ask it, am I fat?
No comment.
That's quite a good one. Or, what is the meaning of life?
Life, a principle or force that is considered to underlie the distinctive quality of animate beings. I guess that includes me.
Ooh, well, given that I do feel that I'm compelled to say please and thank you as part of my rigorous upbringing of politeness, I guess that does include you. So I'm going to stick the scary machine over there and continue with the script. Charles, Apple announced their results later this week. What do you expect to come out of that?
The expectation is that they'll have revenues of more than $33 billion for the quarter which ends at the end of September. So it won't include the iPhone 4S. And that they'll have sold something like 22 million iPhones, 13 million iPads. So pretty big quarter.
In comparison with Nokia?
With Nokia, which is going to be reporting on Thursday morning and which is expected to show probably a loss again in the mobile phones division, second quarter of losses in a row because it still hasn't got a Windows phone out there in the top-end smartphones, still losing share, still being hammered by all its carrier partners who are just beating it down on price and still being chewed away by Android in places like China.
Well, there's all the coverage of the iPhone 4S launch and more on the site at guardian.co.uk/technology. And finally, this week, the sad news that the inventor of C and Unix, Dennis Ritchie, has passed away. Ritchie is one of the heroes of the digital age, although his passing was greeted with far less hoopla and celebrity reverence than Steve Jobs's 1 week earlier. Ritchie created the most essential computer language as well as the operating system upon which most of our computer technologies are built. Dan, what is C and what is Unix?
Unix kind of comes from the days when we had the big old machines, the old mainframes that people in universities and big institutions like IBM and Bell Labs, they all needed to be able to use at the same time, and it needed some operating system to allow that to happen. So they invented the Unix operating system that actually ran the machine and allowed everything to happen. And they wrote that originally in assembly, which is the language that the machine speaks. And then that got a bit complicated. They thought, we needed a language that we can write in that's a little bit easier. So they invented C. Well, they invented B before C, and then C came out of B. So, and then C just stuck, and it worked really well. It was close enough to the machine that they could code in it, but then they could teach it to other people. And he co-wrote one of the most successful C books as well. I mean, I had one when I was young, and most of people I know had the exact same book with the big C on the front. So that's how it all started off. So C was written to be able to run the Unix machine, and then nowadays it's in all the servers and it's in the router. So his legacy is C and Unix basically run the internet. I mean, everything that is runs on. So here at The Guardian, our servers will be running Unix, and all the code we write is Java, which is a child of C. And our Macintoshes as well, all based on Unix and these phones.
Charles, was it a particularly parsimonious or a particularly good language, or is it just that it was the most popular or the only one at the time?
The thing with C was its portability. That it was basically written so it could be ported to different machines, different machine architectures. But also, yeah, it's very effective in the way that you can allocate objects, allocate memory, that you can basically build classes with it. And yes, it won out over things like Fortran and Pascal, because Fortran was very much mathematical processing. Pascal was a sort of conceptual one, but it didn't have the sort of nuts and bolts approach of C.
C worked really well because it was kind of the bare minimum of a language you needed that wasn't saying, put this in this little bit of memory, take this out of this little bit of memory. Mm-hmm. So it did just the minimum they needed to get it to work. And I think that's the philosophy that I really like about seeing where they came from, was they just went, we just need to make this work and make it happen. And then it stayed like that for many years.
It's just abstracted enough
that
you're not quite on bare metal, and yet at the same time it gives you this enormous, enormous toolkit to be able to do things with. Though I think the other interesting thing about it is that because he was working at Bell Labs, and because Bell was under the government antitrust restriction, they couldn't charge for what they were doing, so they had to give it away. So they gave away Unix, and you know, obviously they gave away C. They couldn't charge for C. And I think there's an interesting question of, you know, would they have been, would the world have been different if Unix had been charged for? Would it be different if there was some sort of licensing system around C? That's really interesting.
Read more about Dennis Ritchie's legacy at guardian.co.uk/technology. Last week, Tech Weekly recorded the first of our live event series, the Tech City Talks. The series began with an, at times, fractious debate about skills between the Minister of State for Universities and Science, David Willetts, Songkick CEO Dan Crow, Young Rewired State's Emma Mulqueeney, and Imperial College's Professor John McGee. What is required for the UK's digital economy promises to work? It seems, despite Willetts' recent launch of the Behind the Screen initiative, intended to get GCSE students' fingers on keyboards to code, computer programming skills are not as important to digital success as most people might think. What is important, according to Dan Crow, is entrepreneurship. Now, podcast listener Parker DR finds this depressing. He says, I was one of the BBC micro generation, and personally I found programming intellectually challenging and fun, as I still do 30 years later. I certainly wasn't spending my time thinking how I could make a business out of it. And why, we asked, with the world-class universities at our disposal, hasn't the UK developed its own version of Silicon Valley, which many feel is due to the close relationship between industry and Stanford University and the University of California at Berkeley? The government is trying to import this model here with universities like Imperial College, but Emma and Dan said that there was an important ingredient missing. It's because we don't have a culture that celebrates failure. On the blog, HKS451 comments, despite our welfare state, little about our setup encourages people to do the things that they aren't sure of succeeding at or that haven't been approved by others. Our schools especially are all about pushing people to conform, from the uniform to the curriculum to the Ofsted checklists for outstanding, little encourages experimentation or curiosity. Meanwhile, R042 says, the problem isn't teaching, it's the lack of opportunities to use it. And when the bubble bursts, then all of a sudden there will be thousands of people whose startup suddenly died. It's worth noting Zynga posted a 90% quarter-to-quarter decline recently. Well, you can listen to the podcast of the last live event and do send us your comments at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. But next week, we will be looking at enterprise. Why build Tech City and how can it work? Charles has been speaking to Wikipedia's Jimmy Wales at Tech Entrepreneurs Week about this very subject. Jimmy spends half of his year in London and so explained why he finds the city so interesting for startups.
In the web startup area, it's generally very small companies, small teams who first start developing something and then it begins to grow. If you've got the tax climate right, the regulation climate right, that can come up almost anywhere, but it's going to come up in places that people want to live, where, you know, creative, interesting people want to live, which isn't, you know, San Jose. So I think there's great prospects here for.
What is it about San Jose that you think isn't interesting to people or is not right? Because most people think that the tax climate in the UK is pretty hefty. You have 20% VAT, you've got quite high personal taxes.
There's absolutely sort of bigger picture policy issues. I'm just talking about the creative class. And, you know, if you've ever been to San Jose, I mean, I know, I'm sure it's lovely for some people, but it's not a place that I would want to live necessarily. You know, a big part of what works very well in Silicon Valley is just the, you know, the 100 startups you never heard of who failed, or they met somebody else who's doing something different but similar. They recombine, you know, and that there's a sort of a subculture there, a networking subculture of, young tech geeks, seasoned angel investors, people who are willing to, you know, put up £100,000 with not much chance of return, because if you do that enough times with enough smart people, you're going to come up with something interesting. So all of those pieces of that ecosystem out there, which is a, you know, it's like, if you think the industry of Silicon Valley is something about technology or computers, I think the industry of Silicon Valley, what do they make there? They make companies.
Jimmy Wales with Charles. Now, as we mentioned before, next week we're looking at the UK startup scene and what it takes to create a thriving digital tech centre. The government has decided that East London offers the greatest opportunity. But is this the case? What about the hubs in Cambridge, Bristol, Manchester, Brighton and Edinburgh? Why have the geeks flocked there, and what needs to be put into place to bring them to the capital? Is it about rent control, good coffee, or innovation centres? We'll be speaking with a panel of experts about what inspires clusters and whether the tech city proposition will work with the ingredients they've poured into the pot. If you have any questions for the panel or would like to comment on the subject of this debate, get in touch at techweekly@guardian.co.uk or elsewhere in our network. And of course, all the debates will be magically transformed from one-hour live events into Tech Weekly podcasts, available every Tuesday. That's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Charles Arthur and Dan Catt. Now join us next week in person at Imperial College in London for the next Tech Weekly Tech City Talk. Next Tuesday, you can download the podcast from the event. I'm Alex Kratosky, and the producer was Scott Colley. Thanks for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.